today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Listener Jeff Niebuhr joins us on the show.
That's it? Isn't there more to this intro?
No, that's it. Like, what else?
Like, something about the topic?
Oh, no. We don't want to give it away. All right, we are recording on a Saturday morning, as you hear this, and we're on the Zoom because it's a patron episode, and we have a patron who's going to be on from a couple states away, and my point about it being morning is I got my coffee going. You guys got your coffee going here?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, got it here going.
Ah, there we go. Cheers. Nice mug. What is that mug there, Jeff?
This is a Starbucks mug of the state of Alabama.
Oh, nice.
Which is where I'm from.
Nice. Where you're from, exactly. Nice. There you go. Very cool. I remember when they put out that series of state mugs. They were really well designed. Very nice. And Patrick is wearing the t-shirt of Jeff's recording.
Highly sought after, valued.
Yeah, what is that? What is that, Patrick?
This is the My Forever DJ t-shirt, folks. And if you remember Jeff's project, what I love about this cover and t-shirt is the little map. It's so cool, places they visited and recording, and also some of our country's greatest musical landmarks.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So much fun.
All right. I forgot to mention I got my Led Zeppelin mug here for you guys to see. Okay. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And I mentioned it's a patron episode. Patrons are people who support the show and come on and get to pick the topic every so often. And with us is Jeff Niebuhr. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. Good morning.
Hey, man. Glad to have you back.
And sure. You mentioned you're from Alabama, but you currently live in Georgia.
Live in Georgia. That's right.
But you also have a connection to North Carolina?
South Carolina. I'm in South Carolina today. Yeah. My now fiance.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's great.
So it's very exciting.
Congratulations.
Is there a big rivalry between the Carolinas? Or do they sort of feel like they're kind of a unit?
I don't know. I'm steeped in Alabama-Auburn rivalry more than anything in my life. Yeah. And so everything else fades.
A lot of things do compared to that. Yeah.
I'm sure. Right. Okay. So what would you like to discuss today, Jeff?
Sure. So we're going to go deep dive, or maybe as deep as we can get, to Rick Rubin.
Sweet.
I started listening to a podcast by Malcolm Gladwell. He has a couple good podcasts, Revisionist History. And then he started another one with like one of his best friends from grade school and Rick Rubin. The three of them are like co-hosts of this podcast called Broken Record. And so I kind of went deep dive and listened into that. And it's just amazing. They have incredible guests, everyone from Robbie Robertson to Questlove. Joan Baez was on. And so it's just an amazing, journey of some of the greatest people in music. And then it's funny because, you know, Rick is a pretty good interviewer, but then they'll turn around and want to ask him questions. You know, Questlove was pegging him on, there was one song called Rock the Bells by LL Cool J, and Questlove was like, man, when I found out it was this one song from AC/DC on Back in Black, I listened to that my whole, you know, sophomore year in high school. And that's my favorite AC/DC album. And Rick is like, if you say so, I don't really remember. You know, it was just a cool guitar sound. It's like, what? Yeah, my whole life I've been thinking you're this jolly or whatever. So anyhow, yeah, I got really excited about Rick, and that's what I wanted to maybe just delve into a little bit.
Yeah, this sounds great. So you mentioned the LL Cool J. That would be, you know, from Rick's earlier work in the 80s. But I know that, Jeff, you're a big Beastie Boys fan. We've discussed this
before. That's right, yeah.
And there's a one-album connection there, right?
That's right, yeah. So as I was thinking about what to talk about today, I want to ask two questions. So the first question, how did a Jewish, white, gangly kind of doofus guy from Long Island essentially help birth hip-hop, right? That just does not make sense. Uh-huh. And then number two, how did any hip hop producer transition to such the mainstream in rock, country, pop? It's just, you know, you go look at his discography and it's like, he's the Forrest Gump of the rock and world. You know, he's like everywhere, every time. Oh, that's also produced by Rick Rubin. So I think those are the two questions I'd like to try to explore. And I know a little bit more I'm the first one because, you know, I love the Beastie Boys. And he actually interviewed Mike D and Ad Rock was one episode of the Broken Record podcast. Oh, so that was great, too. There's a little bit of weird bad blood because some royalties never got kind of out of the Def Jam circle. And and so that's one reason the Beastie Boys left, split. But I think that those are the two questions I think we ought to try to explore.
Cool. Yeah. Very cool.
Well, I'll just say before we get into that, my basic knowledge of Rick Rubin is that first phase, the Def Jam phase. Yeah. And of course, I remember You Got to Fight for Your Right to Party video. He's in that, you know, and sort of like when you learn that, like, oh, that guy's like the producer of these bands. You were like, what? Because not only is he like this gangly sort of white guy, but he also looks like he's a metal guy with his long hair and everything, you know. So anyway, and then of course, you know, he worked with Run DMC and all that stuff. So that phase is pretty well established. And then to me, I kind of remember was probably he worked with the Red Hot Chili Peppers for a while, and I think that got a lot of attention. And then of course, to me, the biggest thing was the American Recordings Johnny Cash stuff, right? Which to me is just perfect, just perfectly done.
That's right.
But if you go to his Wikipedia producer discography page, you better be prepared, you know, to scroll for a while. He's produced an S-ton of records, right, of albums, right?
Yeah. And mainly hits, right? Mainly hitting and big artists. And I think he also has a knack for catching artists either early, pre-discovery kind of, or when they need a little bit of a boost, right? And so let's talk a little bit about the early days, right? He was actually in a punk band to begin with called The Pricks. They actually got a gig at CBGB's. The lore is, and he talked about this on his podcast and essentially said, maybe it's true, I don't know. But essentially, the lore is he had friends, they only knew two songs. So he had his friends come and start a riot to shut down the show. And he had his dad, who had an auxiliary uniform from Long Island Police Department, come and shut down the show to put a buzz out there that these guys are crazy. They're shutting down CBGB's. But the real reason is they only knew two songs. He was in another band called Hose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they opened up for a lot of people. They went on tour. I didn't really realize that until I dug into a little bit. And then he started Def Jam Records. And how he tells the story is he was at New York University and going to clubs every night. Clubs. That's where he met the Beastie Boys. But he loved hip-hop. And he would go try to buy hip-hop records, but they were really disco records with people rapping. And he's like, this is not really what I'm hearing in the club. And so he was friends with DJ Jazzy J of the Zulu Nation, and he went to MC Special K of the Treacherous Three, and he's like, man, I love your stuff. I want to do a record. And they had just signed with Sugar Hill, and so he's like, well, I wrote a song that you can use my older brother to go record it. And that guy was Tila Rock, and that was his first hip-hop record that he produced. And it is kind of the blueprint of what is set up next with Run DMC and LL Cool J and the Beastie Boys. Is it's really beat heavy, and it is much more like what was happening in the clubs. And he, you know, because Questlove really, really dug into this, like, how did you know to do that? And he's like, really, it was for me. I wanted a record of the kind of stuff I was hearing in the clubs, and there weren't any.
Yeah.
So we made this record that I felt like sounded what I was experiencing when I was hearing it live. From that, nobody else was doing that. Well, so.
And I think that's key. And I'm not sure that I have any great insight into this other than it did take several years, really, for hip hop studio recordings to kind of, you know, be done well.
Right.
There was really a long period of time where a lot of these guys were establishing a name for themselves as, you know, MCs, right? But you're like you're saying, it was like a live experience. And to actually translate that to something that would make sense as a studio recording, I think people scratch their heads like, how do you do that exactly? Now, I don't know how he figured it out. Like you said, he explained it there a little bit. But I do think with Run DMC in particular, it was sort of like at that moment, it really did like change hip hop production, right?
That's right.
And it kind of solidified it in some way.
Yeah. And at some levels, he was the first one really to do it. It's just crazy that this, you know, unassuming character is the one that figured out how to make the street sound, club sound, and put it on vinyl.
I think a lot of people were mystified, too, by just the sort of idea of the form of the music, which is that it's basically MCs rapping over what the DJ's supplying, which is from records that he got, you know, crate digging or whatever, and mixing them together on the spot. And it's sort of like it almost like, well, how does that become a record unto itself? It doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean?
That's
and,
right.
And right. For whatever reason, you know, he had the vision and he made it work.
A student at school, and in order to get credits as an intern, that's why he formed Def Jam. And then he hired himself as an intern so he could get intern credits, which is just hysterical. And another little side note he put out there, the D and the J of Def Jam are unusually large. And the purpose of that was to highlight the DJ aspect of hip hop. Mm. He's like, that logo was deliberate because we wanted to focus on the DJ. And then I think the next thing that really happened there in the early hip hop was the Kid Rock from the Beastie Boys was friends, was also hired as an intern, even in high school for Def Jam, still out of Rick Rubin's dorm room. And I think, Jim, you may have seen this at the Rocker Hall of Fame when LL Cool J got inducted. Kid Rock was the one that went through tapes as people were submitting tapes, and he pulled LL Cool J's demo tape. LL Cool J was only 16. Kid Rock listened to it, thought it was awesome, took it to Rick, and they, you know, produced his first album, signed him to Def Jam.
Bit of a star, LL Cool J.
So then I think answering the second question for me is, how did you move from hip-hop into a bit more mainstream? And I think the song I would point to is Walk This Way. The way he tells the story is he was trying to make a deal. You know, at this point, hip-hop's happening, right? You know, there's money, and he and Russell Simmons, and they're talking to other labels, and they're signing artists. I mean, Run DMC's second album, Beastie Boy album. And they're talking to this executive, I think at Columbia, which he's now co-president of Columbia Records, which is also hilarious. And so this, you know, older music biz guy is like, it's not just kind of, Jim, what you were saying. It's not really even music. It's like parts of old music.
Right.
And how can we get behind it? I don't understand it. It's, you know, I understood the punks. I understood disco. I don't understand this at all. And so Rick says, well, it's not so different than some things that you're aware of. And he thought, I'm going to play him Walk This Way by Aerosmith. And he's like, you know, that's a hip hop beat they use all the time. And Steven Tyler's not really super singing on that song. It's pretty close to rap. And he took it to him. And as a really almost like a show and tell example of, hey, this is, you know, this is music, and see how it's similar to something you already know. And that snowballed a bit into putting Run DMC and Aerosmith together. And really, Aerosmith at the time, they're the first artists, I think, that he worked with that needed that boost. They had had a huge career in the 70s. They had kind of waned, and this song really helped propel them into a string of hits in the 80s and 90s, even through, you know, 2000s, right?
Yep, total career renaissance for them at that point. It's pretty amazing. And that, man, that single was so ubiquitous at the time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, everywhere you went, you saw the video, you heard the song. It was pretty amazing. It really was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to hear Daryl McDaniels tell the story, which he's told many, many times, they didn't want to do it either. They were like, these lyrics, these lyrics are like, I forget what term he used. Like
he said country.
Country, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It sounds like a country song.
That's right. Like, you know, they were fine with like using the sample from Walk This Way, but they wanted to make their own song. And Rick was like, no, do a cover. That's the key, you know. And, that,
and so Russell famously told him, do whatever Rick tells you to do.
Yeah.
He's on the phone. He's like, go in there and whatever Rick tells you
to do. But I think, you know, getting back to your first question real quickly here, I was just thinking about this now. Maybe it was because Rick Rubin had that rock background that helped really propel hip hop early on, right? Because he brought the right samples, I think, or the right, you know, music as the foundation for a lot of those songs to make it a real record. And then, of course, to make it a record that would cross over, right? And become, and that's when hip hop really exploded in the 80s when all the white kids just, you know, started buying it, right? And it was because of that, because it became a little bit more accessible in that way.
That's
and Daryl McDaniels actually is a huge rock fan. So I think it really worked with Run DMC because he loves a lot of those classic rock bands anyway.
Another thing that I think he did early on was prior to Run DMC and LL Cool J, rap was really 12 inch singles, right?
Yeah.
And they were the first ones to really do full cohesive albums, you know, and I think Rick brought a lot of that too. Beginning, opening tracks, ending side one tracks, open side two tracks, ending side two, and just that flow of what an album really sounds like. And the first real hip hop album I was familiar with was the Run DMC one, and it is a complete album. It has, you know, highs and lows, and it's a package. It's not just a collection of songs. But I think he brought that to hip hop as well.
Right.
That's a great point.
Now,
great
your point. Second thing about this transition into more, you know, sort of mainstream rock music production, that I don't know. How did that happen?
Well, I think the Aerosmith, I mean, that's in 85. So the 87, he produces the Cult Electric.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He also does Christmas in Hollis, which is hip hop.
Right.
But he also does Less Than Zero Soundtrack. And so he was the one that, you know, the Bengals had played that song by Simon Garfunkel for some time live, but they were going to write a song for the album, and he's like, no, that's the song, let's put that on there, and that's a banging song, and I think made that soundtrack what it is.
And for me, I was certainly aware of the Run DMC album, the LL Cool J famous record, right, with the boombox on the front.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, Public Enemy, you know, how he was involved with that and that it was on his label. But the interesting band for me was Slayer, because all of a sudden I was like, what the heck, you know. But, it, you know, it's really interesting going back to something you said, Jeff, at the beginning about him not being able to capture what he was hearing in the clubs, right? He was hearing on vinyl maybe of more of a disco sound, right? Or just a rap, you know, kind of a thing. But he understood, I think, from the beginning, and maybe this goes back to his punk background, or just like you said, understanding where the power came from. Like, he was always able to catch incredible power, whether it was, you know, like the Johnny Cash, you know, the power of just his voice, or Slayer, like South of Heaven and, you know, and Rain and Blood. You know, he understood how to capture that incredible intensity and power. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you think about that, but that's kind of how I put him together. He was a guy who really understood what was powerful and how to make it, you know, come out on a record.
So, you know, Rick talked about Slayer a little bit, and it's very parallel kind of thing. A lot of thrash stuff is out there. He's hearing it, but as he's hearing it on record, it's like muddy and confusing. And so he said, with Slayer, we stripped everything back. We took off all the reverb.
Right.
These guys are intense, super fast players. And so we just couldn't have that in panning everything left and right to make space. And I think that's kind of what he did with those records too. Very similar to the hip hop. It's like, yeah. I want to bring out what is really happening live into the record and get rid of, you know, older production approaches, which are a little maybe more heavy handed, both in the hip hop world and thrash metal world. And
yeah,
so
totally.
So fresh and that eyes point about, looking at it, or fresh ears, I guess, is better.
Yeah. The point about the reverb makes so much sense when you think about it, right? You know, because that got away from that bombasticness and brought it right into your face.
That's
and
right.
That was so great about the Slayer record.
I want to say something here about just my overall feeling about Rick Rubin as a producer, now that you're talking about this, is techniques a little bit. Is when I learned that an album was produced by Rick Rubin, it's usually not that I can guess that ahead of time. Like, certain producers... I'll give you a good example. Jeff Lynne, because he'd work with Tom Petty, and then Rick Rubin worked with Tom Petty.
Yep.
You hear a Jeff Lynne produced album, you can identify it. It has that Jeff Lynne stamp on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I never really get that feeling with Rick Rubin. What I get from his records is just, wow, this artist sounds as good as he's ever sounded. You know what I mean?
Clarity, I think.
He really...
Space.
Yeah, I don't think he takes over the production. He really works to make that artist, to elevate that sound, to make them the best they can be. And what else would you want out of a producer? You know what I mean?
'91, he's doing Red Hot Chili Peppers, you know, Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic.
Right.
And there's a great clip.
That
I'll send you
huge.
This clip. But it's him and Flea, and they're figuring out the bass line. And Flea's, you know, pretty prolific. And Rick goes, no, right there. It's got to be simple. It's boom, 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 boom. And Flea's like, boom, 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 boom. And then simple. And then they're playing it, and it's like, it just makes the song. It's like it makes their whole kind of career at that stage is that two or three note bass line that's just so powerful and awesome. But it's so Rick Rubin. It is, let's strip everything back to just what is the essence and make it pop.
Give It Away is what you mean. Everybody can hear that immediately in your mind. Yeah. So that's an interesting one, that Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic, because you can sort of see the transition there as well, right? Because they, you know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, rock, yes, but also like funk and, you know, even like Give It Away.
Almost rap.
Right. Exactly. Right. So it sort of feels like, oh, that feels right for him to be the producer of that band. He probably understands them better than a lot of other producers they might have worked with. Although they worked with George Clinton, and that was pretty cool. But anyway, so you can see how this is going, right?
Well, then 92 does Baby Got Back, and Questlove is like, how did you get involved with him? He's like, well, I love this song, My Posse's on Broadway. And Questlove was like, you know, he did that song in homage of your early work. And so it's like this weird circle of, you know,
that's
Run
amazing.
DMC and LL Cool J, and then here's Sir Mix-a-Lot, hears that, and tries to do a similar song. And then Rick hears that, and then they do Baby Got Back. It's just, again, Forrest Gump. It'd be hard to believe that if it were in a movie.
Yeah. I hope he got a percentage on that song.
I hope so, too.
I'm
sure he's doing well. So we're only in the 90s. I don't think we're going to wrap it up. But he does Johnny Cash in 94, which I think, you know, we all know are amazing recordings. What I didn't know is he recorded Joe Strummer and Johnny Cash doing a cover of Redemption Song.
It's so good.
Which is crazy. I feel like we should end there. This is...
Okay.
This is only 94, but I feel spent.
That is a good one. That duet. I don't know, were they recorded in the same place or they recorded separately? That's one thing I've never known.
I don't know. It was released after Joe Strummer's death.
Mm-hmm,
It's amazing the way their voices. Well, they never, I don't think they sort of trade off verses. They never sing at the same time, which led me to believe that it might have been recorded separately. But the way the voices sound, you know, in comparison to each other is really, really strong. You know, I'm losing my words here because I'm so excited about this, but you know what I mean? But it really fits together. They're both sort of world weary, you know, in a way.
Yes, yeah. That's a great way to put it.
And a great song.
Really works.
It's amazing.
It's one of my favorite songs. Amazing song. You know, if you've watched the Ken Burns country music documentary series, Johnny Cash was at a low point in his career at that time and was getting no love at all from Nashville anymore. And, you know, other than reissues of his older work, you know, and had to be convinced, I think, a little bit to work with Rick Rubin. He was sort of like, I don't know how this is going to play or how this is going to go over or whatever. But obviously, he made the right choice and it clicked. And he, Johnny Cash, not only had a career resurgence, but he had a resurgence with an audience that he didn't really have before. There was like a whole new audience of music fans who not only, you know, attached themselves to those records, but then went back and learned about Johnny Cash's classic work, and he just became sort of iconic all over again, right? And thanks to Rick Rubin for that.
Yeah.
Because not only did he produce it, but I think this is a case where he led it. You know, he
put it together.
Yeah, yeah. He was like, let's try this song, you know, really pushing
Especially
Johnny.
Especially Hurt, right? Which I think became one of the greatest out of those sessions, and, you know, it's an amazing piece of work.
What are some of your favorites from this period, Jeff? Are there, you know, certain records I know you mentioned?
We hit them. I mean, I think all the hip hop, all the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I never got into Slayer too hard. I love the Cult, right?
Oh, that's one. Yeah, I haven't heard that band in years and years and years. I should go back and listen to that because
I wonder if you made
a
Desert Island game of what you could take. I think I would say anything that Rick Rubin worked on, that would be my Desert Island.
That would be pretty good, man.
You'd have like your record collection. But.
I know. You'd have a big suitcase full of stuff. It would be incredibly diverse as well, man. That would be a pretty great choice if you could take only one producer. Yeah. Man, that's a cool question.
It's kind of amazing. And he, those Cult records, by the way, that he did, I mean, again, they sound amazing. He just really understood. They don't sound dated like a lot of 80s records. You know what I mean? Like he knew what, how to make a.
Yeah, they could have been in the 70s, right? Just as much as the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as you listen to the podcast, I tried to get little snippets, but he constantly says two words often over and over in response to his interviews. And it's just perfect Rick Rubin. Like he'll go, incredible, incredible.
and
then later on, somebody will say something, he'll go, beautiful. Beautiful.
That's all you need.
So those are the two things also I took away.
And the other thing I'll just say, I alluded to this a little bit as well. I think that Tom Petty Wildflowers album is among his best album, among Petty's best albums. And it's partly, of course, because of the songwriting, but I just think the production on that is just amazing. It's like he really elevated Petty to a place he hadn't been, I think, in a little while. And it's a classic
record.
Talked
about that because... Yeah, because Tom Petty was coming off of the three albums with Jeff Lynne, and he wanted to do something different. And Rick talked a bit about it. He's like, I can't do what Jeff Lynne does, right? Jeff Lynne has all these layers, and it's all about, you know, 3 minutes. And, just, you know, like you said, Jim, it's a Jeff Lynne record.
There's a certain sheen on a Jeff Lynne record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he's like, you know, I'm just all about the song. And he talks about the creation process. And it's great to hear him interact with other artists, you know, because he'll say, it seems like we're there when the creation happens, but I'm not sure how much we have to do with it. It's kind of his like Zen approach to it is, there's this thing that's about to happen. Our role is to kind of let it happen and get out of the way. And then it's birthed. It's almost how he approaches it. Where I think Jeff Lynne is much more like the technician that is an architect of a song that's building layers and putting things in and taking things out, where, you know, it seems like Rick's approach is a little more let it be. But he seems so right so often. It's amazing.
That's right. Okay.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it. I thought this was a fun topic. Thank you, guys.
This is great.
Absolutely.
There's more to mine here, of course. All right. Well, thanks very much, Jeff. Thanks for... coming on. Thanks for supporting the show. Happy New Year.
Yeah, you too.
You mentioned the fiance, so do you have a date set?
Late October.
Late October, sweet. All right.
So, in the mountains of North Carolina.
Ooh, nice.
That sounds great.
Sounds beautiful. Yeah, that's fantastic.
All right.
Everybody's invited.
Western North Carolina, everyone.
Yeah. Tell us where it is at your own risk, Jeff.
All right. If any listeners would like to talk about the works of Rick Rubin, I would think that there are a lot of comments out there, a lot of strong feelings.
Tell us
about favorite records or things that you know about him or things you discovered about the work he's done. You can call and leave a message, 612-440-1984. There you go. Or you can email us, rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram @suburbspod. All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
This is Jeff Niebuhr.
We'll talk to you all later.
And the blood gave life to the branches of the tree, and the blood was the price that set the captives free, and the numbers that came through the fire and the flood clung to the tree and were redeemed by the blood.
He's never cut his hair or beard, and so he's like almost this Swami kind of mythical figure with these long gray hair now. He's a sight.